are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, September 18th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, at least a little bit later, very psyched to have singer-songwriter, activist Billy Bragg on his new pamphlet series. Or I should say, in his specifically, his pamphlet, Three Dimensions of Freedom. Also on the program today, Nancy Pelosi mad that there's been any progress whatsoever on impeachment, as Corey Lewandowski highlights Donald Trump's obstruction of justice. Meanwhile, Trump to revoke California's authority to set stricter auto emissions. Even the car companies don't want this, which is why they're getting that antitrust investigation at the moment. Meanwhile, GM workers continue to strike. GM strikes back, stop paying for their health insurance. I thought it was impossible for private health insurance to go away.
There's a boot on your Cadillac plan.
The Fed last night bailed out the overnight lending market. Not sure if that's good. I mean, I should say, I'm not sure what it means, but I know it's not good.
You
the other white
me,
now with less inspectors. This is as Trump relaxes pork inspections for meat safety. Mm-hmm. Enjoy.
Michael University. Looks so grossed out right now.
Yep. Well, beef is next. University of California divests its $13 billion endowment and $70 billion pension of all fossil fuel-related stocks. Big deal. Bernie and Biden now tied in California. Warren's in third.
Corn pop.
Pompeo in Saudi Arabia, presumably with an empty duffel bag, to talk about our response to Iran.
I hope it throws us back up.
The director of national intelligence of the United States is now illegally withholding a credible whistleblower report about we don't know. New Mexico does the impossible. Unveils plans to make its public colleges and universities completely tuition-free for each and every and all state residents who want it. Lastly, Israel deadlocked after their election. One can only hope this brings Bibi Netanyahu one step closer to jail. All this...
That might be the case.
It's actually, yes, that was... That is not hyperbole. If this guy, if Bibi doesn't pull something out here, he may be facing an onslaught of prosecutions.
The so-called progressives are actually regressive.
My son showed me this video. On one hand, Dave might be the most dumb Jew that has ever walked the earth. On the other hand, this was an interesting point. And by the way, a great point.
We will get to all that stuff. All right. Let's just jump right in. There's a couple of major stories to my mind. One, and the hearing with Corey Lewandowski highlights a dynamic that's going on in the Democratic caucus at this point. A big fight over impeachment. And the other day, we'll get to this. In a moment. let's just first talk about, we've got Mike Pompeo is in Saudi Arabia now. And despite the fact that I suggested that he was going with an empty duffel bag looking for more cash so that for, I don't know, for some investment that Donald Trump has, maybe for him to go buried in the back of his golf course in Queens or wherever it is, that it definitely looks like, or I should say, it looks like Donald Trump realizes, because you remember, he cares about nothing, which is, in this instance, going to work to probably the world's favor. He is not interested in getting into a war in Iran. Apparently, the Saudis ran out of money when it came to Donald Trump. And but who knows? Maybe he's looking for a better offer by sending Pompeo there. However, there was Admiral Brett Stevens went on to MSNBC yesterday. Brett Stevens, you'll recall, was the one who pretended being called a bedbug was akin to what the Nazis did to the Jews. Because despite the fact that he is probably, I don't know, the top, one of the top 50 probably paid columnists in the country. I mean, probably top 20.
Makes me so mad.
He doesn't bother to look at the sources that he cites in his articles and builds an entire opinion piece around the idea that a professor calling him a bedbug somehow was akin to fascists attacking the Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto. Oh, and incidentally, he also called that professor's boss to complain about a tweet.
He sent an email to the boss, which he CC'd the professor to. Yeah. He also just wanted to say he did liken, and granted, this is when he was at the Wall Street Journal, so anything does literally go there. He likened the Palestinians to mosquitoes.
Right.
I love the fact that with these people, it can't just be that actually, he's ridiculous and oversensitive. It's actually like, oh, there's actually a direct analogy here.
Put a pin in that because part of Billy Bragg's, you know, it's a small book. It's like a pamphlet, essentially. Talks about that dynamic, actually, by the IDW. Freedom of expression for me, not so much for thee. But here's Brett Stevens basically desperately trying to revive any type or enhance any war tensions, basically arguing that, you know, we can definitely strike them in a fashion that will just be fine. I mean, I'm not even sure what the point of this is supposed to be, but go ahead.
Pressure. And by the way, we should not rule out targeted military responses against Iran if they are proportionate and if it's clear that it's an effort to change Iranian behavior. It's happened before in the past. In 1987, we sank the Iranian Navy without any consequences for the United States. We could do it again. We can signal to the Iranians that we do.
Pause it. I want you to just contemplate for one moment. 1984. What's the difference between now and 1984? In 1984, we did not have thousands of troops in the Shia-controlled parts of Iraq. So, and this is amazing because Admiral Stevens here would know this because of all his war college training that he probably had, is that close proximity of your military assets will enhance the opportunity for your opponent to strike you. And so the idea that this is analogous, oh, we did it in the 80s because, and we got away with it. There was no response. Well, there's going to be other responses. We have troops in Shia-dominated Iraq.
We also did pull... Reagan pulled all troops out of Lebanon in 83, which he should have. But tragically, I mean, Hezbollah blew up an army barracks there. So actually, even in this timeline, we're being a little generous. Though bedbug's known for being very hawkish.
Right. But all right, so but here we go back. So even though that we don't have evidence, we shouldn't take off the table. We shouldn't. take off the table like a military. We can just take out the Navy. It'll be whatever. It won't. Let's not worry about escalation. And exactly like exactly what is supposed to change here? What is the dynamic that's supposed to change with, like, if we just show them that we're willing to take out their Navy, then what? But go ahead.
To change Iranian behavior. It's happened before in the past. In 1987, we sank the Iranian Navy without any consequences for the United States. We could do it again. We can signal to the Iranians that we do mean business, but we're trying to do so in a proportionate way that ultimately leads to a new and better negotiated outcome.
Okay.
The idea being here that if we sink their Navy, then we're going to get a better deal from them or something.
Or they recognize.
Guess what?
We
had a deal. Dumb. Oh, and you know what? I got my boss's number too for you that we can put up on the. I can send him my boss's number. It's mine. It's my number.
Ed, how can he say that in such a calm voice? It's crazy.
You have to. That's literally exactly what you have to do. You have to say it in a calm, because I'm not crazy. I'm just suggesting that we perhaps dilly-dally around the edges of a massive, massive extended another war. I mean, we're wrapping up our existing ones.
Yeah, we've got things
to do. We got to get something else.
By the way, the consequence is Iran recognizes that they better build a weapons capacity with their nuclear program.
Right.
That's the only thing that will assure their security. I also really like Sam pulling out the, you want to speak to the manager?
Right, exactly.
I am the manager.
Exactly.
I mean, I swear I could see you doing a stint at Kinko's years ago just so you could say that to an unhappy customer.
I actually,
in the middle of your acting career.
I worked at a Chinese restaurant where I was the day manager, only because I was the only person who spoke English and no one would.
How many times
would
you pull that line out?
Every time. I'm going to go back and check with the day manager. Oh, the day manager said you can get an extra chicken wing today.
Did you ever do a turnaround? Did you ever like turn to walk and then just immediately turn like, let me go get the manager?
When I got the letter from those patent trolls, I was going to do a whole thing. They wanted to do a video conference call with me about it, because I guess they wanted to like see me eye to eye when they talked about the patent troll. And do you remember this? I was talking about
that
how like
really
I wanted
funny.
To do like a whole thing where it's like, oh yeah, hold on one second. I'm going to go check with our accountant, our financial division to see about, well, you know, how much we can afford to pay you. And I was just going to duck under the desk and put on one of those accountant hats and go back. Folks, in this golden age of television and podcasts, we all know the value of a truly compelling narrative. Q, Hunt a Killer. It's the murder mystery box that immerses you in an ongoing experience. With every delivery or episode, you dive deeper into what it's like to be a detective. You're sifting through piles of documents. You got evidence. You get case files until you crack the case. In my instance, we actually are doing the bulletin board. You got to do it. And instead of staring at a screen, you can build an investigation board with friends or an online community helping each other through every challenge. Plus, the proceeds of every box goes to the Cold Case Foundation to help fund cold case investigations. I'm doing this with my daughter, and it's really one of the few times she will actually even engage with me whatsoever. It's exciting to wait for the box. It's exciting to wait for a package, but it's also it's great fun. It's like it's a much more sophisticated version of those like games you used to play, you know, trying to figure out who done it. And she, a part of it, I mean, she was super, super into like Law and Order, and she was like binging on Law and Order things. And I was like, well, let's just
popular,
do this.
Super popular.
And
show.
I think it's fun. And it's not on a computer. But if you do want to go online, you can do it with other people that way, or you can just do it with friends. I don't know how you would do it if they were remote, but it's interesting and lots of fun. And right now for our listeners, you can go to huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off your first box. They only accept 200 members per day, so hurry, take advantage of this offer. That's huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off your first box. huntakiller.com/majority. All right, let's go to these hearings that took place yesterday. There is a report out today, and we're going to get to Billy Bragg in about 45 minutes. He's going to call in. The other day, we reported that well, we'll get to that. This is reported by Politico. In a closed-door meeting last week, Nancy Pelosi stunned lawmakers and aides with a swipe at the Democratic staff on the House Judiciary Committee. Pelosi criticized the panel's handling of impeachment in harsh terms, complaining the committee aides have advanced the push for ousting Donald Trump far beyond where the House Democratic caucus stands. Now, I think this is an I don't know if this I think this is a disingenuous position. She does not. This is not a question of weight for all the Democrats, because we do have a majority of Democrats now who are supportive of impeachment. That happened after the Mueller testimony. I think the latest tallies I saw were close to 140. So the well over 50%, closer to 60%, maybe more. And this is without any effort by the Democrats to make a cogent, compelling case on how you impeach Donald Trump. And what took place the other day was the Judiciary Committee basically took a vote that was about the procedure and how they were going to handle this. And this is really important, because the Lewandowski hearing yesterday was basically a train wreck as the members of the Judiciary Committee questioned him. They get 5 minutes each. It's completely disjointed. They don't seem to be on any type of page. I mean, you know, and everybody's probably got their own ego. So the idea of like sitting everybody down and saying like, hey, Betty, you'll ask this question. Bill, you'll follow up by asking that question. I mean, it's just they for whatever reason, they can't do that. But in the resolution that they passed the other day, when they talked about procedures in investigation and how they would handle the investigation, one of the things that they voted as a rule of the committee is to allow staff lawyers to question. And I think they're going to get a little more savvy about this when they start to when these things start to become public, because they didn't allow the staff lawyer to question until the end of all the other questions by the Democratic congresspeople. And I guess presumably Republicans, to the extent that there were any there. And this was the most compelling testimony, because you've got a professional lawyer who is, in this instance, a defense attorney. Guy's name is Burke. And this was a very effective. I mean, there was a couple other points where, you know, people made some broad points. But the question here is that is about obstruction. And it's about Corey Lewandowski's receiving from President Trump instructions to tell Jeff Sessions to give a speech saying that Donald Trump is completely innocent of everything.
Here's a speech idea.
The truth, in other words, that's what we call
that he was going to retake control of the Mueller probe. You'll remember Jeff Sessions had recused himself because of conflicts. He was going to take control of the Mueller probe. He was going to limit Mueller only to investigating meddling for future elections.
Right? Like this clean slate, clean slate.
Mulligan.
So like 2016, let's not go backwards. Let's go forwards.
Yeah. Move forwards.
Forwards. So in other words, he was going to pre-investigate any type of problems that would happen in the 2020 election.
Wow.
Now, Corey Lewandowski
was not,
Corey Lewandowski at this time was not an employee of the White House. Corey Lewandowski was a former campaign manager looking to be brought into the White House. So the president asked him to do this. And much of this is in the Mueller investigation. But it is there without any conclusions as to whether it was obstruction. The fact pattern is there. The conclusions are not, because Robert Mueller, for whatever reason, thought that Congress would be picking this ball up. And that's what they're doing now. And so the nature of the questions are asked, he's asking Lewandowski are, why didn't you follow through? If you thought that what the president was asking you was perfectly legal, why didn't you follow through? Because what they're trying to establish is that Corey Lewandowski knew that if he did this, that he would get wrapped up in obstruction of justice. And so here's Lewandowski basically trying to sort of dodge and weave, but it gets, it's almost impossible. He's going to try and say, like, I'm not going to tell you about any conversations I had. And so what the lawyer is now doing is like going sort of sideways around it. You don't have to tell me about any conversations you had, but I see shadows of those conversations. Now you can comment on the shadows. Good.
Questions are not for me.
Let me ask you this, sir. Prior to the Mueller report being published in redacted form, did you ever misrepresent what you did on behalf of the president?
I can't think of an instance where that would have occurred.
Pause it. Okay, so the question is, the president asked you to do this, and we're going to find out that Lewandowski actually, you know, contemplated taking the message, tried to find other people to take the message. And so the lawyer's asking, like, did you ever misrepresent what you did prior to your sit down with Mueller people?
For the president.
I can't think of an instance where that would have occurred.
Let me show you an interview that you did on May 14th, 2019. Excuse me. I'm going to show it to you from February 22nd, 2019. Let me show it to you. Excuse me. May 14th, 2019. Thank you.
I don't ever remember the president ever asking me to get involved with Jeff Sessions or the Department of Justice in any way, shape, or form, ever.
Did you hear that, sir? That was you saying on MSNBC, you don't ever remember the president ever asking you to get involved with Jeff Sessions or the Department of Justice in any way, shape, or form. That wasn't true, was it, sir?
I heard that.
And that was not true, was it?
I have no obligation to be honest to the media just because they're just as dishonest as anybody else.
So you're admitting, sir.
All right, pause it. Now, understand what just took place here. Not only did he say, well, yeah, I lied on that TV show because I'm not obligated to tell the truth. That's true. But it also means that he lied 20 seconds earlier where he says, I certainly did not misrepresent what I did. So he's just lied in the committee and he's saying that I lie on television. But then the question is, we're going to move forward to, why did he lie? Like, if it's no problem, like, why would you lie? And it's not like Corey Lewandowski is a humble guy. And I don't want to seem like I'm important to the president.
I have no obligation to be honest to the media just because they're just as dishonest as anybody else.
So you're admitting, sir, you were not being truthful in that clip, correct?
My interview with Ari Melberg?
Yes.
Can be interpreted any way you'd like.
Would you like me to play it again?
You're welcome to, please.
Play one more time.
I don't ever remember the president ever asking me to get involved with Jeff Sessions or the Department of Justice in any way, shape, or form, ever.
And, sir, it is true in May 2019. You absolutely remembered when the president asked you to deliver a message to the attorney general of a speech for him to give related to the special counsel investigation. Isn't that correct?
I'd have to think about it.
Are you claiming, sir, that, and you had been interviewed by the special counsel about those very events in which you discussed and you said was accurately reported in the report a year earlier. Are you saying, sir, you may have forgotten it by the time you were interviewed just before the report was publicly released?
I'm saying my memory was clearly much fresher when I actually gave the interview with the special counsel's report.
Sir, is it your testimony before this committee that when you said you did not remember the president ever asking you to get involved with Jeff Sessions or the Department of Justice, you were saying you were being truthful? And, sir, I don't believe there's any reason to consult with your counsel. The question is, are you a truth teller in that interview?
I'm a truth teller every time I stand before Congress or a committee of jurisdiction and raise my hand and swear to God under oath.
My question, sir, is when you said the president never asked you to get involved with Mr. Sessions.
I have no obligation to have a candid conversation with the media whatsoever, just like they have no obligation to cover me honestly, and they do it inaccurately all the time.
So you're admitting that on national television you were lying there.
What I'm saying is they have been inaccurate on many occasions, and perhaps I was inaccurate at that time.
Boom. All right. Now, look, it's not a big deal to get Corey Lewandowski to admit that he is a liar on television. I mean, it would be more of a problem if we were at CNN and we had hired him to go on television for us and talk.
No, wouldn't be. Don't worry about it.
But it is a problem because it begs the question, why were you lying? What I mean, if what the president asked you to do and then you refused to do, but you didn't actually refuse. He just basically said, I didn't get to it yet. Why would you do that? Unless you knew that what the president was asking you to do was illicit.
Maybe he's just messing with him.
Here is
I love dumb slick guys.
Yes. And this is this is about when Lewandowski basically said, like, this is a bit of a hot potato. The president wants me to do this. I don't feel comfortable doing it, or I just don't have the time. Remember now, he's trying to get a job at the White House. He doesn't have time to do this. So maybe I can get somebody else to do it.
Reference me the page number so I can review it.
Sir, did the president ask you do you remember testifying earlier that you said the president said if Mr. Sessions will not meet with you for you to deliver that message, you should tell him he's fired, correct?
Again, if there's a reference to the report, I'd like to refresh my memory. It's been a long day.
Sir, how about
sure
if I
you appreciate
you,
that?
How about if I reference you to your testimony? Do you recall testifying to that earlier today?
Again, it's been a long day. I believe it to the best of my knowledge that that's what I said, but if there's a reference to the Mueller report, I ask you to point it to me.
So let me ask you, sir, if it wasn't a priority for you to deliver the message, why did you enlist Mr. Dearborn to deliver the message for the president?
Again, I can't speak to private conversations I would have had with Mr. Dearborn at the advice of counsel.
Not asking private conversations. The fact that you did it is already disclosed in the report. I'm asking you, why did you do it? Why? What's going on?
I knew Mr. Dearborn.
Why did you do it?
Can I answer now?
Please.
Okay, I've known Mr. Dearborn since his tenure as the chief of staff to Senator Sessions. He was my primary point of contact for Jeff Sessions during the Trump campaign. And I also knew that Mr. Dearborn had continued, like I did, to have a longstanding relationship with Jeff. And if I wasn't going to be seeing Jeff, I figured Rick would be able to deliver that message.
Well, sir, did you try to see Mr. Sessions again? Did you call him after the president told you to do it and see if he would meet with you this time? Did you call
Not
him
to
once?
The
Please answer the question.
Not to the best of my recollection.
And, sir, is the reason you personally didn't call him, someone who you said you were friendly with, was because you knew what the president asked you to do was wrong, and you, sir, didn't want to get in trouble. That's why you didn't do it.
You know, Mr. Burke, I've asked and answered that question. I'm not a lawyer, but I didn't think that he was asking me to do something that was unlawful at the time, and I don't think that was the case now.
He goes on to talk about not being a lawyer quite a bit in the context of trying to get,
you know, I'm not a lawyer. Like, you say lying to Congress is this, you say it's another. Like, I didn't go to a fancy.
It's a bulletproof defense.
Yeah.
But the problem with his claiming that he didn't think it was wrong then, he doesn't think it's wrong now. I mean, this is where you get to see sort of the squishiness of the entire process of the Mueller investigation. The fact patterns are there. The question is, Was it obstruction of justice? Did people have an awareness of what was going on was wrong? And Corey Lewandowski would have you believe that despite the fact that the president asked him to do it, despite the fact that Corey Lewandowski asked somebody else to do it after realizing after a month that he wasn't going to do it, that he had no reason not to do it other than it just wasn't a big deal. And so I think there's two things that are going to come out of this. And we should say that Rick Dearborn and Rob Porter, that's the guy who I think had a domestic abuse issue, was working in the White House, which I know is a confusing thing to say because apparently there was multiple people with that issue. Yeah. But the White House said that Dearborn and Porter have absolute constitutional immunity from testifying, which, of course, is also BS. And at one point, the committee has got to start to exercise some actual punitive actions when people don't show up. Lewandowski couldn't pull it off because he didn't work for the president. So the idea of executive immunity is absurd. But the executive immunity is absurd in the first place, across the board. So the other big thing I hope that comes from this is that Nadler realizes I put the lawyer first. I put the lawyer first so that the staff for all the congresspeople can find out where the nugget is. The lawyer uncovers it, makes it clear, rattles the witness, and then the congresspeople can go and kick the carcass, as it were. Hopefully this will happen. Hopefully they can swallow some of their ego and allow this to be done in the most effective way. Because if this half hour had been at the beginning, I guess maybe the only argument you could have is that maybe after all that time, he was a little bit more, he wasn't quite as sharp. But maybe you do it twice. But I think we're going to be seeing more of this. I think we're going to be literally doing what we just did today more and more often going forward. That's my hope anyways. But Nancy Pelosi seems to be unhappy with that. Because from what it appears, it's not just a question of we don't want impeachment to fail. We don't know if it can pass. It's just like the idea that there would be investigations into this stuff is somehow problematic in terms of the election. And that's just absurd. It's just absurd. It is still believing that somehow, I don't know, there's some contingency of people out there who are inclined to vote against Donald Trump. But if they are made more aware of all of his wrongdoing, they're going to be less inclined to vote against him.
It's absurd. No, but then Trump might be able to act like he's being persecuted unfairly.
Right.
By the
which
left.
Is something he never does.
Don't give me that opportunity. I'd never do it unless there was a reason.
We mentioned this. There's an ongoing strike, GM. I mean, there's not much else to say that you have 48,000 workers. The GM has decided to stop paying their health benefits. Now, of course, they don't pay people during a strike. The UAW gives, I think, about $250 a week to each worker from the union strike fund.
And we can donate to the strike fund, right?
I would assume so. I would assume there's got to be a way to do
it. I'll put a link.
Because now that strike fund is also going to be paying COBRA health insurance. I mean, when you see this dynamic, right, and the union's going to have to pick up the tab, which can be anywhere from $1,700 to $2,000 on COBRA. COBRA is a disaster.
Oh, yeah. I tried to use it once, and I just laughed when I saw how much it was going
to
cost me.
I had a gap between Air America and Bob's Burgers, and the the Cobra, you know, looked like wasn't going to get coverage for, I think it was, you know, possible for a baby coming. And the Cobra was a disaster. I mean, $2,000 a month. It's just absurd. It's just absurd. And
this is America.
This is America. And, you know, the one thing you also realize is, and the backdrop of all of this is that there's also a certain amount of power that is given to labor if the government is providing for its health insurance. And, you know, I will reference it again. Go read Wrecked, and you will see the level of sensitivity these major corporations have to labor power, regardless. I mean, ultimately it may be about cost, but it runs parallel to cost. They want the flexibility of control. And, this is one of the mechanisms of control. And you could see it right here. They're exercising their control by stopping to pay for their health insurance. Now, this is not a situation where these people have walked off and quit the job. 50,000 people have walked away from the job. But this is the way that they're going to smoke them out. Speaking of autos, we mentioned this. This has been coming for a while. It really is stunning. Andrew Wheeler, the head of the EPA, trying to reconcile the notion of a conservative's belief in states' rights and the U.S. government saying that California does not have the ability to set its own emission standards. Andrew Wheeler said, "We embrace federalism and the role of states, but federalism does not mean that one state can dictate standards for the nation." That dictation is obviously just a function of their market share, which, of course,
the market, folks.
Right. The market is speaking. But it's a problem for them. So that's just another. And I'll just hit this one before we go back to some more clips. So the USDA, in addition to sort of like being completely destroyed in terms of the, you know, the scientists who are working there and taking them away from Washington, D.C., the Food Safety and Inspection Service is currently responsible for overseeing what is known as the kill line. It makes sure that tainted meat does not enter the food supply. Under this new program by the Trump administration, they would basically privatize the federal oversight of pork facilities, cutting the number of federal inspectors by about 40% and replacing them with plant employees. Right? So, oh no, we're doing a great job. No worries. No worries. And they've done this. Apparently they did this with the chicken kill lines. The agency announced it would let some chicken slaughterhouses speed up their kill lines from 140 birds per minute to 175 birds per minute. So this is a classic case of we're going to increase the profitability of these meat processors, and we're going to do it at the expense of the health of the consumer. Because undoubtedly, as you increase this, it's like any other. This dynamic exists in everything. As you take away inspectors, as you increase the speed in which this stuff goes through, and you limit the amount of time that they're inspected, and you limit the amount of time that people have to do these jobs in a hygienic way, you're going to have some person, some kid, some elderly person probably die because something has gotten through at one point. They'll fix it.
Competition would start kicking in.
Competition kicks in. And that's basically it.
Killed my kid.
So
not the other one.
The family and society will pay. They will pick up the tab for the extra profit that these companies can make. That's basically it. That's the dynamic. That's the dynamic that we see across the board. This is why you see it in the rollback of all sorts of environmental protections. It's either A, because corporations are going to profit, or B, as in the case of what we're seeing in California, when the car companies themselves don't even want to lower their CAFE standards because they realize in a couple of years, somebody's going to come in and say, there's going to be a new president who's not going to be a nut job and is going to say, you're going to have to raise these again. And they just want consistency. And they know that their consumers are already saying, like, we want less emissions. We are worried about the planet. And so there are two instances when the Trump administration and Republicans broadly will do this. One is because they want corporations to make more money. And the other is because they want to further the principle that there should be no inhibition on the making of profits by corporations, even if in that one instance, it's not about corporate profits. It's just about basically saying, this is the way it is. And we are disciplining you to understand that this is the way it is. We're going to have no precedence of you can protect consumers or citizens at the cost of corporate profits. We're not going to have any instances of that whatsoever. And that's what this is, and that's what the car thing is about.
Don't you wish this were a Greek drama and one of those tainted chickens was going to find its way into Trump's McNuggets?
That would be awesome. I mean, you know, as a drama,
get back to me.
As a story, that's an awesome Greek drama.
Awesome Greek drama.
Speaking of a-holes, here's Boris Johnson attempting to salvage the disaster that is his, I mean, I don't even know what I can't quite figure out what's going on in Britain, but does he have, you know, he doesn't have a prime ministership anymore, does he?
No, he is prime minister. He just doesn't have a majority in parliament, so we're just in stasis. There isn't an election scheduled, and
he's like a lame duck, I guess. But
he's like an active lame duck.
And here he is trying to shore up his image by going and visiting sick kids. And a dad basically calls him out on it. Here he is.
There are not enough people on this ward. There are not enough doctors. There are not enough nurses. It's not well organized enough.
Right.
The NHS has been destroyed.
Right.
It's been destroyed. It's been destroyed. And now you come here for a press opportunity.
Well, actually, there's no press here.
What do you mean there's no press here? Who are these people?
Sir,
yes,
we
sir.
Need to stop raising
the voice. We're here to actually here to find out how much we can do.
Well, that's not going to fix things now. It's a bit late, isn't it? I mean, years and years and years of just NHS being destroyed. And you're telling me there's no press here?
Well,
there's no press here.
As far as I'm aware, this is not a meeting.
This is a press opportunity. You didn't invite the press here. You didn't ask them to come. That's what you don't have a press handler back there.
Sir.
Okay, well, fine. Well, in your la la land, believe whatever you want. Thank you.
Good. I mean, that is just fantastic. And I also enjoy watching the sort of the hospital official trying to be like, oh, this is going sideways. The NHS has been under assault for quite a while in Britain, and it's just, they're starting to feel it.
You keep cutting,
and it's going to start to make a difference.
Well, this is what's interesting here, and it's great he's being called out, because the cuts began and accelerated under Cameron and Clegg and then under May. And what Boris is doing is, see, Boris has a political advisor who's eccentric and smart. And basically, there's a video of him, Dominic Cummings, who led the Brexit campaign. He said, just like here in Britain, but there's actually video of him saying this a year or two ago, saying, look, the center of this country is to the left economically and to the right on things like the death penalty. And constantly, just like here, they always assert that the center is to the right on economics and socially liberal, which it isn't. And so at any rate, what Boris is doing is he's superficially pretending to jack up funding for things like the NHS. So it's not just that he's going and getting backlash. He's kind of running a scam campaign on basically, you know, he's bragging he's going to have the biggest investment in public services since the Blair government of 2002.
Listen to the dads, folks.
Right. That's not going so.
No, so it needs to be. But it's also, I mean, it's all the more reason that you do need a left flank on him because they are clever.
Here's Ro Khanna. We were talking about this UAW strike. Here's Ro Khanna explaining why Medicare for All is how it empowers workers. And ultimately, you know, look, again, like that Recht interview, they destroyed their own business model. They weren't aware of it, that they were doing that, but they destroyed their own business model to disempower unions, to disempower labor. And so much so that their competitors did the opposite. And so ultimately, while Medicare for All will enhance labor, it's also bound to enhance business in some fashion because they're not going to have to deal with this. You're not going to have to be running a separate company that is with an entire skill set that has nothing to do with what you're doing.
I want to talk to you about this auto worker strike in Detroit in the context of healthcare, in the context of your candidate, Bernie Sanders, because he says that under Medicare for All, companies that negotiate healthcare with union workers would have to pass on any savings to those workers that they might receive after all Americans shift over to the Medicare for All coverage, because these workers would be shifting largely from Cadillac private plans to Medicare for All. But I wonder, looking at these auto workers, we know that discussions are very tense today. They don't have a whole lot of faith that their employer is going to do things their way or is going to stand by them as they should. Do you see how maybe they personally might be skeptical that their employer is not going to do this in any way other than kicking and screaming?
I do, but here's the sad thing, Brianna. These auto workers shouldn't be having to fight for basic health care. What they should be fighting for is increased wages. And the reality is unions have had to scrape just to get health care coverage. What Senator Sanders is saying is we're going to make sure everyone has health care coverage so unions can work on getting better pay and better working conditions. And we're going to force the employers to honor the agreement with the unions and compensate them for the extra health care benefits that they may have negotiated in the past.
I mean, it's a fairly easy dynamic to understand. If we had scarcity for, let's say, like milk and cheese and eggs in this country, and it was inaccessible to people for whatever reason, you'd see employers who have the ability to secure that stuff say like, oh, well, so much for wages, but you're going to get milk and cheese.
I have a Cadillac plan. I just want to reiterate that. And there are plenty of things that it does not cover.
Right. I mean, it's even once you have that, it's incredibly expensive.
Like, I'm still getting bills and phone calls from the NYU Langone Center from this cancer scare that I had last year.
My kids go through that, too. And it is I keep getting bills for like $13 that then end up like metastasizing because you got to pay each one. It's like a second business. It's nuts. Meanwhile,
it's a racket.
Here is Sarah Nelson, who is the flight attendants union chief. We interviewed her at Netroots Nation this past year. Also, you can go back and hear an interview I did with her on Ring of Fire. It was the flight attendants who basically dropped the hammer during the government shutdown and told Mitch McConnell, you better start up the government again, because otherwise you're going to find it impossible to fly around the country. And she tweets out a note to anyone who wants to use union members as a wedge to oppose Medicare for All, because remember this, like unions, they negotiate for healthcare, or they provide healthcare through the unions. Different, it depends on which sector you're in or what industry. And there's some talk of, you know, trying to tell union members, like, you're going to lose your Cadillac plan. But she makes the point, UAW has one of the best plans in the country, but management can still use it to hold workers hostage. Medicare for All puts power back in our hands. So she, as a labor leader, understands the genuine dynamic that's going on.
Yeah, it's not rocket science. Like, one more analogous example, when you give people who can't afford food money to spend on food, there have been studies about this, they buy more school supplies for their kids. Just things of that nature. It frees you up to work on other stuff.
I don't know what's going on with that. I'm trying to pick up calls, but I don't think we're going to be able to do that before we get to Billy Bragg. In Israel, Bibi Netanyahu, look, it's pretty complicated, the electoral situation in Israel. But basically, parliamentary system, two of the major parties, one of which is Bibi Netanyahu's, essentially tied. I don't know how else to articulate that.
Yeah, 32 for Gantz's party, 31 for Netanyahu as Likud, last I saw.
And that means that other smaller parties are put into sort of a leveraged position because they have the ability to join those parties. Avigdor Lieberman, who is, I don't know, maybe he's been surpassed by other figures in Israel, but
he's got
pretty
about
fascistic.
Nine votes. I mean, he's,
I mean, I'm talking, yeah, in terms about being fascistic.
He's secular fascistic.
Yes.
That's what it is. I mean, there's a big division there.
And so his party won, how many was it?
He got nine seats. Shas got nine seats, which is the ultra-Orthodox party. And they are, and basically Netanyahu's in a bind because he has to go either way on that, and they won't work with each other.
Right.
And then the third, I think it's Yamina, which is like the fascistic settler party, they got seven, which is a big underperformance for them.
So Lieberman won't work with the ultra-Orthodox, and they both need to be there if they're going to win. On the other side of that, Lieberman may not work with the party that is represented largely by Arab civil rights activists. So there's a bit of a stalemate right now.
That's the joint list, and that's probably I just want to say that's a positive light. They got 13. They're actually the third highest vote getter. It goes 32, 31 to 13. And then you got Labor, and then the Dem Union thing, which is Jeffrey Epstein collaborator Ehud Barak's centrist effort, I believe. And then actually there's this at eight is UTJ, which I don't even know what that one is. The Israelis really, every Israeli election is like a confirmation of all the most hacky Jewish like jokes about Jewish arguments. Like, this very small country, lots of activity. Oh, okay, no, they're ultra-Orthodox as well.
But the at the end of the day,
United Torah Judaism.
At the end of the day,
which is Sam's party.
They may end up doing another election, but unlikely. Nobody wants to do that. And there may, Bibi Netanyahu, of course, has a real reluctance to not be in power because there is an ongoing investigation of him. And apparently, all right, let's pick up this call.
He might be gone. And just want to say really briefly, in addition to that, maybe, even though the policy sets are not there at all yet, maybe if he's finally removed, the bigger conversation about ending the Israeli apartheid system can actually happen.
We'll see about that. But
in the meantime, with the joint list, it would be through the joint list.
I think we have someone on the line. Call from an 810 area code. Who's this?
Hi guys, it's Mark Monkey calling from the former industrial nexus of the country. Flint, Michigan. Just calling about some strike news. I know you guys have a interview coming up with Billy Bragg, so I'll try to make it quick.
Please. All right. Yeah. Let us know. Tell us what's going on there.
Okay. So some of the news from some of my friends that are on the strike right now, our local news has been reporting a lot of misinformation, including that they're not getting paid $250 a week, but they're getting $250 a day. We've had to do a lot of damage control, everyone in Flint, obviously, to help our union workers who we support. There's been reports released about strikers being in the middle of the streets blocking traffic. And that, of course, is not true. Damage control there. All this, again, reported by our local news. And, of course, the fact that they cut the insurance off from all the workers while they're on strike is definitely a beautiful thing that they're doing right now.
And do you have a sense of like your friends on the picket line? I mean, what's just the general attitude? I mean, do people feel like they've got to be there for, or are they anticipating this is going to be a long strike? And how do people feel about that if they are?
I haven't really heard anything about how long they believe the strike is going on. I know tempers are high right now, especially with the local media working in that way. But the fact that they are tying the temporary workers to the negotiations might call for it being a little bit more difficult to negotiate, because General Motors loves having these temporary workers that they can have for a couple of years, to pay them at $14 an hour, which is way less than what a full-time employee gets paid, work them to death, and then fire them.
Right. Well, I guess we'll see. If you get more information, please call back in. I appreciate it.
Of course. And if you want to follow me on Twitch, twitch.tv/MARCMUNKY. I will be trying to report more tonight around probably 5:30 Eastern Standard Time.
All right,
thanks
great.
Again, guys.
There you go. Thanks. I appreciate it, Mark. All right, folks. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking to Billy Bragg. I guess we'll do a freebie Wednesday today. Just a reminder, it's your support that allows us to do this program. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. You get the extra content every day. You get it commercial free. But we will continue on. I guess I'll do the post roll after the interview, right? Yeah.
You should do it after the whole show.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So we'll be back in just a minute with Billy Bragg.
Take my union.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a real pleasure to welcome singer, songwriter, and activist Billy Bragg to the program. Billy, welcome to the program.
Hi, Sam. How's things?
Things are great. I got to tell you, this is a huge honor for me. I first saw you over maybe close to 35 years ago. You performed at my college, and back in the 80s, and you were a big important force in my musical development and my political consciousness. So I really appreciate this opportunity to talk to you.
Thanks for sharing that, Sam. I appreciate it too.
So you've written a pamphlet entitled "The Three Dimensions of Freedom." This is part of a series, is that right?
It is, yes. My publishers, Faber, they're called Faber Social. They're part of Faber and Faber, and they specialize in books about music or books written by musicians. They published my Skiffle book in 2017, the Roots, Radicals, and Rockers. And last year, they said they're going to start this program of putting out these, they're kind of like polemical essays. Mine is about 17,000 words. It's about a 90-minute read. And they were asking me if I had anything I'd like to write about. And The Three Dimensions of Freedom focuses on the necessity to that equality and accountability must be present in order for us really to be free, that liberty alone, free speech alone, is not enough to guarantee everybody's freedom. And it's something I've been thinking about for a long time. I've written songs about it. I've spoken about it at events. And this gave me an opportunity to draw all of my thoughts together, particularly in the light of the election of Donald Trump and the Brexit in the UK.
Yeah, and I should say, I mean, you manage in that this brief essay to move from Mount Pelerin to Gamergate to Joe Rogan gets a mention, all the way to Brexit.
Yeah, I think I'm trying to work on a number of levels. You know, the basic premise that freedom demands both liberty, the right to express your opinion, equality, responsibility to respect other people's opinions, and then accountability. That's the absolute key one. I'm trying to bring that to bear, not just on the politics of the day, how we deal with the rise of authoritarianism in democratic societies, but I'm also trying to give people some parameters with which to monitor their social media discourse, to be able to try and work out if the person they're dealing with online is acting in good faith, whether they are willing to give equal space to your opinion that you're expressing, and more importantly, whether they are willing to be accountable for what they've said and what their actions are. And I think it's the lack of accountability, the lack of respect for equality online that undermines so much of our deliberation that goes on online. And that's why I'm trying to offer some parameters for that, as well as talking about the major politics that are going on in the world.
Yeah, and I thought you did a great job of that, frankly. And that's, you know, a beat that we spend a lot of time on. But let's just talk a little bit about the concept of liberty, because I couldn't help but be reminded in this, you know, just sort of, I guess, I imagine this was you did this consciously, the three dimensions of freedom, sort of in some respects echoing FDR's Four Freedoms speech, where he was, you know, not redefining, but I guess more specifically defining what this concept means, and essentially taking it away from the right and allowing people to get a better perspective on it. And like you say, the accountability runs, the need for accountability runs through all three of these sectors. But let's just talk a little bit more about this notion about economic liberty, like so-called economic liberty, because that is ostensibly what the right would have us believe this is about. But in fact, their notion of economic liberty really clouds the actual notion of liberty itself.
I think it does, because their idea of liberty is the right to exploit. And I mean, that's a key aspect of capitalism. But when you get to a situation where that is not regulated in any way, that's when it becomes dangerous. Capitalism, ultimately, I believe, is like fire. You know, if you tend it, if you keep keep looking on it, it will give you heat and it will give you light. If you leave it untended, it will destroy everything in its path. And I'm afraid for the last 40 years, since Reagan and Thatcher, we've lived in a time where capitalism, neoliberal capitalism, has been deregulated constantly, and politicians have argued that the market has the answer to all of our problems. Now, when a politician says that, they are shirking the accountability that goes along with democracy. You know, people think that democracy and accountability are synonymous, but I'm afraid they're not always synonymous. Their relationship is more like a Venn diagram. And there's sometimes when there's consensus in a society, that Venn diagram is overlaps, most of it overlaps. But at the moment, under Donald Trump and with Brexit in my country, I'm afraid accountability and democracy are going in different directions. You know, you live in a country where the person who gets the most votes in the election doesn't win. I live in a country where a tiny majority vote for a huge constitutional change, and we're not allowed to question it or challenge it. So these are difficult times for those of us who believe that democracy is absolutely crucial, but unfortunately it's become untethered from its ability to hold those in power to account, whether they're politicians or, more difficult, whether they're buried deep within corporations.
Well, what do you think about the notion? And maybe this is just on my mind. We interviewed Bhaskar Sankara yesterday, who's the editor of the Jacobin, and on his socialist manifesto. And what do you think, I mean, to extend that metaphor about fire, what do you think about the notion that, I mean, the argument that I think that he was making on this program was that you can control the fire and you can make sure that it's being used for its proper purposes. And if you don't, obviously it'll consume everything. But his argument, I think, would be that the existence of that much flame is inherently problematic and will always get out of control. And, you'll have periods of time where you can control it, but at other times you won't. And you get what we've had over the past 40 years and counting. And that, from his perspective, the idea is that maybe we need to snuff out much of that fire. You know, maybe some embers are okay, but you got to keep away everything that is dry from it.
People have been talking about that for a long time, and I've been involved in movements that have been focused on that. But before we snuff it out, we've got to make sure we're not snuffing it out into darkness. We need to see what the light will be once we've snuffed out the fire. And until we're able to show people what the light will be when we snuff out the fire of capitalism, they're going to be understandably rather sort of doubtful about the validity of that. So we have a little bit of a way to go. I'd like to think of it more in the sense that accountability is, or the other way around, maybe socialism is another name for accountability. And if what I mean by that is what the UAW are currently doing. You know, they're organizing, they're going on strike for greater agency in the workplace, to have some say over their wages and their conditions in the workplace. You know, when ordinary working people have organized, it's always been for greater accountability in the workplace. And in my country, the Labour Party grew out of the union movement. So I think it's really accountability that we bring to bear on capitalism that then actually ensures that it works for the benefit of the people and stops that exploitative edge that as socialists we're always trying to combat. I've never been a revolutionary. I've always been someone who's tried to reconcile the contradictions within the system and within human nature. And what I'm trying to do with this book is identify accountability and equality, but specifically accountability, as the key component that we need for individual agency, because I think both the election of Donald Trump and Brexit are manifestations of ordinary working people feeling they no longer have agency over their lives.
And I have to say, to that end, I mean, I really appreciated the part two when you talk about equality, and you're specifically in some respects talking about the freedom in addressing the rights sort of ongoing project of essentially saying that if you criticize us, you are stifling our free speech, while at the same time, in attacking what they call political correctness. At one point, you talk about Eric Weinstein, who is the guy who coined the phrase IDW, is someone I've actually spoken to briefly, at least. And you write, in his refusal to recognize the reciprocal nature of freedom, that you must respect in others the rights that you claim for yourself, Weinstein reveals that the intellectual dark web, to be a party to the strain of irate exceptionalism that runs through the new generation of free speech warriors. What do you mean by that, the strain of irate exceptionalism?
Well, they believe that they should be able to say whatever they want to say, whenever they want to say it, to whomever they want to say, with no comeback. And that's not free speech that they're trying to get there. That's free reign that they want. You know, and when people do come back at them, they complain terribly, you know, and they say something outrageous, and then they say, oh, I'm not allowed to say this. You've already said it, mate. This is ridiculous. Stop clutching your pearls. You're already there. And they do have the right to say that. I respect Eric's right to say whatever he wants to say. But equally, he has to respect my right to hold him to account for what he says. Because free speech without equality is nothing more than privilege. If you don't respect the right of others to criticize what you've got, what you're saying, and this is important, respect their view when you go back to them and when you speak to them. You know, in the book, I take a quote by Eric where he talks about how open to debate they are, and then immediately says, except people who believe this, we're not going to talk to them at all because they don't, you know, they don't work on the same level as we do. You can't. That's not how free speech works. You know, he's trying to narrow that down. And that's what concerns me about the new generation of free speech warriors. It's not free speech they want. It's free reign that they want. And I'm afraid that's not how freedom works.
And I mean, it's I guess I appreciate your addressing this, because I think this is something that particularly young people and who come online. I think, you know, specifically when you talk about folks like Jordan Peterson and this crew and Joe Rogan, you're talking about young men largely or older boys. And there are very few voices out there who are making the point you are making to those people who come and you know, you sit down there, you watch these guys who are all sitting there, they're all nodding their heads to each other, and you presume, well, they must be right because they're all in agreement. And it's important to have this, I guess, intervention.
Well, I mean, you know, we're all capable of doing that, Sam. Even on the left, we're capable of doing that, to get out of our bubble. What I'm trying to give young people is, well, left or right, are parameters in which to be able to have a discourse that you learn something from, that is beneficial, that doesn't descend to, 100% universal agreement or anger or bullying, abuse. You know, you have the right to offend, but you don't have the right to abuse. And I'm afraid the modern concept of free speech doesn't really take the idea that there are parameters on board. Let's take, for example, So I actually quote this in the book. It's something that George Orwell said. And it is that if liberty means anything at all, it means the right to tell people what they don't want to hear. Now, the problem with that is that by saying that, Orwell is saying, actually, it's okay to say 2 + 2 = 5, which is the example that he gives in 1984 about how the system is so bad, you know, because if everybody is allowed to say anything they want to say, you know, if you've only got a liberty and equality, and anyone can say whatever they like, then you still aren't able to focus in on the fundamental truth of any particular matter. That's why you need accountability.
Right.
That's why accountability is the line we have to draw in the sand, whatever our politics, and say, this is where we're going to make our stand. We're going to hold you to account. If you are lying to us, we are going to hold you to account for your lies. And we've got to keep focused on that idea of accountability, whether we're talking to the President of the United States, the European Commission, or some toe rag who's having a go at you on Twitter.
I mean, this that lack of accountability feels to me to be the sort of the and I think you express this in your essay in the years running up to Donald Trump. I mean, and you know, these are obviously problems that have that well preexisted Donald Trump. But in the years running up, there was a greater awareness, it seems to me. I mean, I have hosted many people over the past 10 years prior to Trump talking about two tiers of justice, talking about the failure to hold the banks accountable for what happened in 2008. The idea that, you know, I mean, just Jeffrey Epstein. I mean, just you can find examples across, you know, frankly, Donald Trump, Steve Mnuchin, half the people in the administration, they exist because there has been a failure for society in a myriad of ways to hold people accountable. There's been two or multiple systems of justice that have not been applied equally.
I mean, this is what I'm trying to get at with the book. You know, this is the thing that over a long period of me looking at the situation, I've identified as the hole in the donut, if you will, the lack of accountability. Because the great struggle, it seems to me, in a modern democratic society, and this is what underpins what you Americans refer to as the culture wars, and that is the struggle that answers the question of, one, who gets to write the rules, and two, and this most important of all, who gets to break them and get away with it. And that clash right there underpins the whole narrative of political correctness. When Donald Trump identified in the Democratic nomination process and one of the debates, the greatest problem that America faced is political correctness. I mean, political correctness, you know what I'm saying? It doesn't even exist. It's no such thing as political correctness. It is a trope that is used by reactionaries to police the limits of social change, to stop things happening that they don't feel comfortable with. There's no, you know, there's no set of intellectuals writing theses on the ideology of political correctness. There's no people marching on the streets demanding more of it. There's no party trying to get elected on a platform of political correctness. It is a complete chimera. It doesn't exist whatsoever. And yet Trump is able to say it's the greatest challenge that America faces today. I mean, this is how ridiculous we've got in the discourse. And of course, the idea that he's doing that, and it was in answer to a question where he was asked about his behavior towards women. So he was literally using that trope to avoid accountability. And that's where the problem lies. I think wherever you hear that phrase being used, political correctness, virtue signaling, any of these tropes, you have to ask what the person using them is trying to deflect you away from.
Right. I mean, this is simply a reaction to the idea that a certain person or a certain group is essentially saying, like, hey, wait a second, I'm drawing boundaries here. And these are boundaries that the people who are complaining about political correctness have never had to observe in the past.
Yeah, I mean, look at all the dynamic campaigns that have arisen over the past 5 years. Me Too, Black Lives Matter, the what we call in England Extinction Rebellion, the protests against the climate change. I mean, these are all accountability movements. These are all movements that are seeking to hold people to account for their sexism, for their misogyny, for their racism, for their disrespect for the environment. Accountability is the cutting edge these days of our politics. And unfortunately, the way that your politics is set up with such a polarized Congress and Senate, it's impossible for those accountability to work, because there's that rejection of any kind of being, you know, being held to account within the system itself. That's where the problem is.
Well, to the extent that, I mean, there is some addressing of that accountability. You see movements like you say, Black Lives Matter or Me Too movement, or, you know, at one point, like the Occupy movement, I think was yeah. a similar moment of accountability. What else can we create as vehicles for accountability beyond that? Or is that simply just we need to reinvent those same movements, you know, continually?
Well, it works on a lot of different levels, Sam. It's not a one-size-fits-all simple answer. And I'm not offering answers in my book. I'm offering parameters with which to judge the person that you're encountering, the politics you're encountering. In the 20th century, we had ideology to do this. Whatever your ideology was, left or right, you could use that ideology to look at a debate and work out whether you're in favor of it or against it. You could get your bearings, if you like, on the debate. We've kind of lost that with the decline of ideology. And what I'm trying to offer with the book is the reason I said dimensions is because I do want to try and create a space where the two sides can talk to each other, where we can overcome polarization with deliberation, with respect for one another. Because I think that's one of the things that really is lacking in the debate, any respect that the person who is arguing with you might be coming from a position which is justified, but just happens to be different to yours. So what I'm looking at in the book is a recognition of accountability and equality as being these two key principles that we bring to our personal discourse with one another, but also to the way that we see the world. And so that we recognize that the debate we're going to have is going to happen within this space. Because, you know, there's a lot of talk with free speech warriors about the idea of safe spaces. Now, a safe space is set up to ensure that there is a debate, not to close down the debate, but to ensure that there is a debate. It's just that if you come into that safe space, you have to respect the person you're arguing with. You have to listen to them. You have to let them speak. And you have to accept if they're holding you to account for something that you're saying is outrageous. And unfortunately, your average free speech warrior doesn't want that. They want to go in there and they want to offend as many people as possible to the limits of I would argue, abusive behavior. And then they want a reaction, they get one, and then they make themselves into the victim. And it's almost always, I hate to say this, it's almost always white men who do this, because they're desperate for a bit of victimhood. Because they realize that their privileged position in society has left them at the moment in a situation where they're having to respond, rightly so, to Black Lives Matter, to Me Too, to the driving gas guzzlers with the climate school strikers. So this is the respect that you need to come into a safe space is, I prefer that much more to Eric Weinstein's idea of debate, in which he's not going to talk to the people he doesn't agree with. I mean, how does that help bring anything forward? How does that help Eric widen the scope of his ideas, even? Never mind me arguing with him, but in his sense, it's no good for him if he only talks to people he agrees with.
If in fact he is interested in widening those ideas, which
you've got to think that if you've got, I mean, you know, I've written a book because I want a platform to talk about these things with people like yourself. And I'd be happy to go and debate this with Eric. I'd be happy to go and talk about this on Joe Rogan, because I'd be, you know, it's a terrible thing to say, Sam, but I might learn something.
Right.
They might have a perspective on free speech that I haven't picked up because of where I'm coming from. And they may say something that allows me then to go away and sharpen my idea. That's what discourse is about, mate.
Right.
That's how you learn stuff. You don't learn it by sticking your fingers in your ear and saying la, 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 la when someone is trying to give you a different perspective of your position. These guys want the license to say whatever they like. They're not interested in the liberty that allows us that fabulous, right that people have struggled through the years to express your opinion and then to put it into the marketplace of opinions. They're not interested in the marketplace of opinions. Like the neoliberalists they are, they want to dominate the marketplace and they don't want any competition. For capitalists, they're a very, very bad example, I have to say.
Yes, well, indeed. Although I guess, like you write in the book, those guys at Mont Pelerin would have been proud.
That's right. Yeah.
Billy, are there going to be more pamphlets to find this? And people, obviously, this is out there now. And also, I should just tell people, just as a public service, that you're going to be you're on tour right now. I know you're in Virginia, and soon you're going to be up here in New York next weekend.
At the Bowery.
And then up in Cambridge, Mass.
I'm doing some. I'm actually, if people are interested, I am doing some book related events. I'll be at the Brooklyn Public Library in New York City talking about the book next week, and I'll also be in the Cambridge Public Library. If you get in touch with them, the Cambridge event is on the 1st of October, and the Free Library of Philadelphia on the 23rd, so that's next Monday. And then I'm in New York City at the Brooklyn Public Library on the 25th of October talking about this.
On the 25th?
Again, as I say, the 25th of September. Okay. At the Brooklyn Public Library, Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! Is going to be talking to me about the book. Oh. And it's interesting because in the Q&A afterwards, I pick up, because obviously, I'm sure you know that there's a different perspective on free speech in the US as there is in Europe.
Right.
We have slightly different perspectives on hate speech and other issues. So it's always interesting to come as a European and to talk to Americans about this, to get that other perspective that allows me then to see if I can then articulate what I'm trying to say in a way that makes sense with the American definition of free speech, different though it is.
Well, I will be there. I'm going to be there. That's Wednesday night at the Brooklyn Library. I will be there, and I'm looking forward to it. Billy, thank you so much. A real honor and a pleasure for me to have this opportunity to talk to you.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity to speak to your listeners and your viewers. I hope it made sense to them.
I would hope so. All right. I appreciate it. Thanks again.
All the best, Sam. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was fun. It is weird to have a conversation with the guy that you saw and admired for the first time 35 years ago.
Yeah. And then to talk about Eric Weinstein.
And then to be like, yeah, spend that much time talking about Eric Weinstein.
Yeah, I had one of his tapes that I would listen to in my car in my teenage years just over and over again. Yeah. When I was getting somewhat political, I don't agree with him about capitalism, obviously, but it's still cool to hear from him.
There you go. That's all he wanted, that opportunity for you to hear his words. And
he should get on Rogan.
I would be surprised if Rogan didn't have. I don't know. But that's exciting. I'm going to go see him at on Wednesday night. They're definitely going to go do that. All right, folks. Well, I guess we're just going to continue on with the show. it's whenever we break format, it's disorienting for me. All right, let me call into the phone system. What is this clip of Joe Biden that we have? I mean, am I going to get annoyed by this?
Well, it's him. It's him saying that he's going to free up 720 million women for the workforce with some program.
Here's Joe Biden.
This is a bold goal.
This is pretty good. I'm trying to do the math here. Wait a second. That's a lot of women. All right. Well, here's Joe Biden.
That is a very high number.
Look, I can tell you that, like, we're not seeing it completely reflected in the polls. Apparently, you know, in the latest NBC poll, which is it's considered a high quality poll. Biden went up. Warren went up. Bernie basically stayed the same, dropped a little bit. This is the national poll. California, on the other hand, you have Biden and Bernie tied, which is reflects, you know, both Biden dropping and Bernie popping up. I mean, we'll see what happens in Iowa, and seeing some polls out of there. It's a little bit tricky to tell. Who knows? You may get like a Pete Buttigieg, you know, surprise in Iowa. That doesn't seem impossible from looking at some of these polls at this moment. I mean,
I just don't get it at all.
I mean, I think, you know, there is, it is very easy for us sitting around with each other to forget that there are people out there who, you know, have vastly different perspectives on things as us. I mean, this is chapter one in my book, Blame the Electorate, I'm formulating. But, I mean, we'll see. I think that the likelihood that we're going to see some type of brokered convention increases, you know, every day, because there does not seem to be any movement, you know, a breakaway. Now, of course, it's very early. What happens in Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina are going to make a big difference. But if California is much earlier than it has been in the past, and the implications of Bernie winning, let's say, California, are or really any of the top three candidates winning California, is huge, really huge this time around, because it happens early enough that it's going to impact the other states. But I can tell you this, that, you know, and I have conversations with people who are journalists and sort of like, you know, center, and sometimes politicians occasionally, you know, just not interviews, just not even necessarily, you know, on background, and just, you know, general, just get to take people's temperatures. And to a person, I have yet to find, even when they are ideologically comfortable with a Joe Biden, I have yet to find a person who has confidence that this guy can win. Now, this is a real problem, because there are clearly a cohort of people out there who are convinced he can win. We can see it reflected in the polls. That's where a lot of his support is from. It's not even that they like his proposals or lack of proposals or whatnot. It's just they have bought into the idea that he can win. And this is a very scary situation, because, and someone, like I used this analogy yesterday, is leaking oil. Someone had said that to me. And the thing that's dangerous about leaking oil, as opposed to, let's say, he's got a blown head gasket, is that you got a blown head gasket, you can't even make it onto the highway.
You could run on E for a while.
Well, no, the point being that you blow a head gasket, you pull over on the side and you're done. The car, you got to just call for a tow truck. It's done. But if you have if you're leaking oil, you're driving down the highway and you don't realize it, you can get a certain distance, and then all of a sudden the engine seizes up.
It's a guessing game.
Yes. And that's what scares
Very
me.
Big and guessing game.
Here
it's
so obvious.
Here is Joe Biden leaking some oil.
You get a tax break for a racehorse. Why in God's name couldn't we provide an $8,000 tax credit for everybody who has child care costs? It would put 720 million women back in the workforce. It would increase the GDP, to sound like a wonk here, by about 0.8%. It would grow the economy.
Yeah. Wonks also are aware that it's very difficult to put 720 million back into women back into the workforce when we have a population of less than 350 million, is my understanding in the country. Is it somewhere around 350?
Yeah.
And that makes it very, very difficult to put 720 million back into the workforce as a wonk.
Yeah, this reminds me of another wonk.
As a wonk.
Another wonk classic here.
As a wonk.
It's 3 million executive branch employees versus Trump, okay? Yeah. Trump's role is...
Is that right? That's not right. There's 3 billion?
Million. 3 million executive... I think there are 3 million executive branch employees. That may include the military, by the way.
There you go.
3 billion? No,
3
Tucker,
billion.
I know the government's bad, but that's a lot of people.
Oh, my God. I'm totally against it. This government's got way too big.
Wait a second. There's only 5 billion people in America. 3 billion people work in the government.
But obviously, he's just misspeaking there. Aside from the fact that, like, you know, the tax credit, I mean, I guess it's one way to do it. The other way to do it might be to actually just provide universal pre-K and pre-pre-K.
Decommodify.
Well, I mean, right. Decommodify. It's also, it does show, though, that even taking everything else aside, that Joe Biden, not just by instinct, but by his whole career, is a walking embodiment of all of the bad turns not even the modern Democratic Party, but the Democratic Party through the 70s, 80s, 90s, and aughts, from a right-wing turn on foreign policy and a variety of other issues. And just the fact that – and this was – if you read, like, third way – people should go back and check out, like, you know, the – third way archives from the 90s. It's like, it's all that stuff. There's a major problem. It affects some of our constituencies. Obviously, we're not going to center it. Obviously, we're not going to solve it fundamentally. Tax credit. I mean, everything is just a tax credit scheme or a public-private partnership, which always makes things less efficient.
Yeah, I also hate the idea that the only reason we should get any help from the government whatsoever with taking care of our families is so that we can go off and work ourselves to death.
Well, but it's 720 million women who are going to go into the workforce.
That's a lot of women.
We're going to be very productive.
Well, here's
and
the
then
thing.
While they're working, that someone could come in and tell them how to raise their kids if they're black.
Well, this is...
And you got the record player on. That's another 40 million.
I mean, we could probably just take 300 million of them and retrofit all the pipes in America.
Well, that's
right,
what I'm saying.
Right,
so this
right.
is Jamie, this is the thing you're not picking up. 720 million women come into the workforce. We're all going to have like one day a week work weeks.
We can all have a woman that works for us.
Fair enough.
Like, welcome to your orientation. This is how you do a right wing Mandela impression.
There would be 20 women working here who would be doing all of our jobs.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you for coming. This is the Social Security briefing book. And right around 11:45, I get extremely cranky in the prep.
There you go. Exactly. You will all tell everybody be quiet in the office, please.
Ideally, if you could fit it in between a random anecdote from Hollywood in the late 90s.
Exactly.
How are you with Lavender?
I will totally train 10 women to do my job. It'd be awesome.
That way they don't got to go to the majority report every day. It's a different team every day. Now I'm a wonk here. I don't want to sound like a wonk.
Do we? Yeah, exactly. Don't worry. Mission accomplished. I don't know this for a fact. And I imagine we could try and look this up. But I don't know if we could find this information. But and maybe this we can actually task people with this. Here is that guy, Tom Homan, who's the former ICE director, who was going around saying all sorts of horrible crap about, I can't even remember now what it was, but he's on Laura Ingraham's show. I think he's taking a quick break from maligning brown people and basically speaking out against California wanting to ban private prisons and private ICE detention centers.
So he's still maligning brown people.
Right, of course. He's just not doing it explicitly because This is what I wanted to ask people with. Find out which board of directors he sits on of which private prison company. I mean, I think it's like there's or who he's lobbying for, but whatever it is, there's the idea that this guy's not making any money from a private prison complex. Very possible, highly unlikely. And I would include in that also like food services or whatever it is that he's, you know, like we sell tasers to private prisons or whatever it is.
Well, he's in the PR wing of the private prison industry for Fox News as a Fox News contributor.
Indeed. But here he is basically spreading. And this is, there's so much data on the inefficiency of private prisons that it's stunning. I mean, it's really one of the most, and like all this work was done 5 or 6 years ago. But here he is.
Prison needs to remember he's part of the United States. California is in the United States.
Is it still, Tom, really?
Well, it's supposed to be. And look, he ought to spend less time in El Salvador trying to talk more people to come to this country illegally and take care of the homeless problem he has in California. And I've many times been in California. How many homeless veterans on the streets of California? Yet he's running down El Salvador to try to get more illegal aliens to come. And he wants to shut down ICE facilities, put U.S. citizens out of work. And he says he's doing this for the immigrant community. But again, let me be frank on this. This will damage the immigrant community. They don't want to leave the state. They don't want to leave their families. They certainly don't want to go to a county jail in Louisiana or Texas. Our facilities are grade A, highest detention standards in industry. Anybody can go to ICE.gov website, look at the detention standards. Highest in industry, lowest deaths in custody of any state or federal facility.
So whether they're for-profit or not-for-profit, or they're run by the government, high standards.
High standards. And
pause it. Now, just take 1 second and contemplate who are in ICE detention facilities versus who are in federal and state prisons. And then ask yourself, is that really a big achievement? Lowest number of deaths? You're putting people who have not broken the law in any way, certainly not violent offenders, into these detention centers. And you're bragging that we have fewer deaths than in places where we have like people who are there for murder or for assault or.
Nice of him to recognize the southern prisons being especially bad. That's pretty woke.
Yeah, but continue.
Or not for profit, or they're run by the government. High standards.
High standards and highest in industry, and plus. The private sector does things better than the government. The most expensive beds ICE has, are the ones we own. We don't do it very well. The government, the contractors, they do this for a living. They're accredited.
All right.
They're the highest.
But it sounds good, right? We're going to shut down the profit making.
That's what it's about. He wants to run for president.
Separating families.
He wants to run for president.
Yeah, we're going to shut down the profit making in.
We're going to stop profiting off of kidnapping children and imprisoning people in a money making capacity.
The way that.
August 18th, 2016, the Justice Department announces that they plan to end the use of private prisons because officials concluded the facilities are both less safe and less effective at providing correctional services than those run by the government. The idea that you can have a business that sets aside a certain amount of its resources for profit and it be less expensive begs the question as to like what's going on at those prisons that you're able to both set aside money for profit and make them more cost effective.
Well, from their point of view, it's a win-win-win because they don't view prisoners as people. And if they get to bleed them dry for the commissary or whatever and make profit off it, that's an added bonus.
There you go. Naomi Klein is... there's a big... You know, this University of California divested... And from it has something like a $14 billion endowment and a $70 billion pension. I mean, the University of California system, it's pretty big, obviously. But you're talking about a total of like, I don't know, what, $83 billion, somewhere around there? Maybe, yeah, $84 billion. And they are divesting their holdings of anything involving fossil fuels, both because it's becoming a risky proposition to invest in fossil fuels because everyone knows the future is coming and fossil fuels cannot be part of it. But it's also because they want to make sure that the future comes and divesting. This is a big deal. Because the argument that you're putting at risk a pension by not owning oil stocks, or you're putting at risk an endowment by not owning coal stocks, fracking stocks, or whatever it is hard to make when you've got an $80 billion fund that is willing to divest in that way. That's a big deal. And Bill McKibben at 350.org, I think he's still there, has been working on this for 4 or 5 years. There were people at the end of the Obama administration who were getting arrested for this type of divestment. It is, in some ways, this divestiture movements brought about the changes in South Africa, at least to the extent that America played a role in it. It was largely because companies were finding that doing business in South Africa was beginning to hurt their stock values. And so they basically went to South Africa and said, like, this is not sustainable. And I guess I'm getting a little sentimental of a divestiture talking to Billy Bragg today. But also, Naomi Klein has a new book out. She was on Democracy Now! Talking about the what is happening with the climate movement, and particularly in this segment, some of the dangers that are represented, as we saw with the El Paso shooter, referencing a diminishing amount of resources, and therefore that justifies us throwing some people overboard.
I write about the Christchurch killer in part because that horrific attack, which stole the lives of more than 50 people in New Zealand at two mosques, happened on March 15th. And that day is significant for many reasons. One of them is that that was the day of the first global youth climate strike. That is the day that 1.6 million young people around the world walked out of class and took this stand for international solidarity with children all around the world. It really a movement that is in no way nationalist, right? That is calling for justice at the center of our response to the climate crisis. In Christchurch, the student strike, the rally after the student strike, was disrupted, and the students were told to disperse because there was a live shooting just a few blocks away at the mosque, and that was the killing that I referred to earlier. And one of the things that was really different about that attack, and he did take inspiration from all of these different mass murderers, was that this killer identified as an eco-fascist. That he said that in his manifesto, wrote that in his manifesto. Talked about how immigrants were destroying Europe, destroying, you know, the Christian world and so on. And, you know, I think there's been a lot of focus in recent years about how do we change the minds of the climate deniers, right? I think the only thing scarier than a far-right racist movement that denies the reality of climate change is a far-right racist movement that doesn't deny the reality of climate change.
I mean, there you have it. If anything, the idea that this is being cited across, you know, from, you know, the lunatics, fascists on the right, just give you a rise to the reality of this, of its existence. And the idea that we still have the only major significant, maybe the only, but certainly the only significant political party in the world, which is organized around the principle that, and I'm not exactly sure where they are at this point, that either climate change is a hoax or just simply not, there's nothing we can do about it. Just get it. God will take care of it.
Well, or as some in Silicon Valley, they're actually planning for those scenarios and buying eco bunkers and building scenarios for them.
Well, at least they're aware. They at least acknowledge that it's happening.
That's true, but I think that's the correlation of the point I just want to make, that of course it's important to acknowledge or accept or whatever word we're going to use the science of it, but that's not the
it's
a political question. And ultimately, as the right wing quote unquote accepts the science, if the politics is still maximalist and apartheid,
it's going to turn into mass deaths.
And this is what Achille Mbembe, again, I always cite that piece, The Age of Humanism is Ending, which he wrote before 2016, and all of the dynamics are here. And that's exactly the point. And it also correlates with the viciousness and racism towards refugees, because a lot of refugees are eco-refugees and also internally in countries as well. So you need to deal with the politics. The science is a second order question.
Yeah. And this is not new, by the way. There is a long history of people on the far right taking an interest, however disingenuously, in the environment.
I don't think it's disingenuous.
Like some of
the Heidegger.
Then you look at where their money is invested, and it's in fossil fuel companies. So, like, I listened to a really good episode of Trillbilly Workers Party with my friend Brendan O'Connor, where they talked a lot about all of this web of connections, this element of the right that takes an interest in the environment. And it's always been that way. Some of the early eugenics people were into environmentalism, but I think it's going to catch on more and more as, like you guys said, more people on the right accept the realities of climate change. And as we see waves of migration that we know are going to be caused by climate change, right, and the left needs to be ready with a real response to that. We need to be making the case now for the free movement of people, and we need to be making the case to the wider working class how this, in fact, benefits everyone and doesn't hurt us to let people in who want to come here.
Yeah, it's sort of a scary thought. Just a reminder, somebody just told me I did not say the name of the Billy Bragg book at the end of the interview, The Three Dimensions of Freedom. We'll put a link to, obviously, in the podcast description.
I think Republicans started unrolling their climate policy when Trump started saying build the wall.
Right. And in Europe, I guess the point I was making is that there are some in Europe who do, and even historically, like, you know, Heidegger, right? I mean, was a very important philosopher who also was a supporter of the Nazis and also a incredibly important eco-philosopher. So there is some depth to that tradition.
Yeah, and like all the Malthusian concerns about population control and stuff like
that.
Right,
and that's why Bill Gates is very bad for you, not good. Why are you obsessed with the population rates of Malawi when you talk about climate change?
I wonder.
I wonder. Bill Gates, not good.
But he's done so much for education.
I saw a thing on Bill Gates recently where he was like, economists actually don't know what they're talking about. It's like, how about, do you know what you're talking about with regards to schooling in America or like population?
Of course he does. He's a billionaire.
Deplatform billionaires.
A lunatic.
Let's go to the phones, and we're taking IMs. I've got it open. You can IM us through the app at majorityapp.com. Calling from a 406 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from? A wind tunnel?
Hello?
Hello?
Help. Hi. So excited that I finally got through to you. This is Pete. Pete from Indiana.
Welcome to the program.
Hi. I've been a longtime fan of you, first-time caller. I have a new boss at my work, and heard him the other day listening to Rush Limbaugh.
Ooh,
actually,
yeah.
And since then, I've talked to him a little bit, you know, working around each other, and I asked him about, I mentioned your guys' name, the show, The Majority Report, and he actually said that he'd heard of you guys and watched a couple of your videos.
Yeah. How'd that go?
Yeah, he was not impressed, to say the least. Really, he said that he just started telling me stuff that you know, you look like a foot with glasses, you know?
Yeah.
And like
foot with glasses.
Weird stuff. Like he just said when you played your videos, he could instantly smell the clam chowder and Old Spice through the screen.
That's true. And we like, actually pumped that commissary through the camera.
That's a partnership with YouTube.
Yeah. The new scratch and sniff videos we're doing.
He said you look like the human embodiment of Applebee's.
We do advertise exactly. That we're from the heartland of America. I think we're doing well.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I just kind of going off what he said, you know. Like I said, I'm a huge fan.
Right. I can tell. You know? I can tell, of course.
Yeah. He said your content was as dry as a Popeye's biscuit. I don't know what that means.
Popeye's? Very popular, very popular, successful fast food.
That's some good Popeye's.
Yeah.
Oh, really? Okay.
It sounds like this guy may be exactly where we want him.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that really got me, he said, is that you know, he thought you had a nice voice, but you kind of look like a hobbit that was born prematurely.
Right. Well, I mean, it's radio, so that's the important thing is the voice.
That's true. You're right. You're right. Hey, thanks. I got to go. Good luck, you boomer.
Okay.
Those are fun.
That is fun. I like that, actually. It's honestly significantly more tame than what my son says to me every day. Every day I wake up, my son wakes up, and the first thing he says is like, "Oh, you're here." Honestly.
Devastating.
He says, like, "I like mom much better." And I'm like, I understand. And he goes, is it your night or mom's night? If it's my night, he's like, "Darn it." And yeah, no, he's just it's relentless.
I kind of wanted to turn it into like a Sopranos bit, but that's
your
kind
son
of
is the ultimate insult like, comic. Yeah.
How about you get me a fucking juice box?
Right, exactly.
It's not even a mom night, but
then
God
he just
sake.
Goes and he goes, "Hold my book bag."
Could you hold my book bag?
I want to run. I want to run to school. Yeah. Hold my backpack.
Wonder where he learned that from.
I'm trying to cut down our interaction time.
Calling from a 646 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hello?
Hello?
Oh, hi, this is, hi Sam, this is Lou from Brooklyn.
Who is it? Hello?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're from Brooklyn, and what's your name again?
Baloo? Lucinia from Brooklyn.
Okay, yeah, you're breaking up just a little bit, but go ahead, what's on your mind?
Okay. Well, yesterday you guys were talking about the WFP endorsement.
Yep.
I saw it. I was disappointed, but I wasn't really surprised about it. But I just thought, like, I thought that Bernie's campaign could, like, tighten up on a few things, like, based on that endorsement, because, like, they're not really doing a good job differentiating Warren from Bernie right now. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, one of the main differentiations people see is, like, maybe the filibuster, and I don't think that's a really good look for Bernie. But optically, like, I usually see Warren, like, endorsing other candidates. Like, she, like, the day that WFP voting started, like, she endorsed the WFP candidate.
Right.
And she's also endorsed the Justice Dem at this point. So, like, I think the campaign-wise, they're probably doing really good with, like, the ground stuff. But, like, certain things like this make Warren look more like she's, like, working on expanding the party more so than Bernie. So, I think, like, there's just, like, a few concerns, like, I thought, like, his voters, like, more of them would be coming more from, like, expanding the electorate, and I don't really see, like, an emphasis from the campaign on registering new voters. I see probably from, like, volunteers and stuff, but I would think, like, with insane deadlines coming up, like, they would be focusing more on, like, getting people registered. And, like when he was blowing up the Joe Rogan interview and things like that, like, I didn't see, like, really them capitalizing on that opportunity. So I just think, like, I feel like they should work on, like, a digital strategist more, like, in terms of, like, registering voters. And I'm just hoping, like, because I don't think a Biden collapse is, like, inevitable or something to come. And I don't see Warren's momentum dying down because, like, she hasn't gotten her card pulled yet. And I don't know if it's going to happen because based on Kamala's last performance, like, I don't think it's like she's not really trying to win anymore. I'm not sure. So I'm hoping, like, he'll work more on, with, like, black voters over 50. Like, that's one area he's really, really weak in.
Right.
So I think he needs to work more on that.
Well, so, I think, you know, I think I think to the extent that Sanders is doing is working on behalf of candidates, I think that's happening. I think it's also happening in the terms of, like, you know, organizing people on the ground in a way that may not get the same amount of attention. Now, that may be not the best strategy. I have heard that in terms of, like, you know, working the WFP, that they didn't that you know, the Warren people were more aggressive in that respect. I think there's other dynamics going on with the WFP. You know, we don't know.
Still haven't released.
They haven't
been transparent about the actual vote here,
yeah,
which is
they're
important.
They're not going to.
And and I'm hearing a lot of interesting anecdotes about that type of thing, which is all I'll say.
Yeah. But nevertheless, I mean, look, the bottom line, the name of the game obviously was work those officials who had a more weighted vote in this instance. That didn't happen. I mean, I tend to agree with the idea that the campaign could be doing more to be more expansive. But, you know, we'll see. It's hard to know, you know, to make this assessment until you start to actually get on the ground. I mean, the California polling, that could be the most important thing that really comes out of this week. I mean, it would have been nice to get the WFP nomination for Bernie. I'm not sure that the WFP could do as much for Bernie as they could do for Warren. But if Bernie wins California, that is going to be, you know, hugely significant. And, you know, every campaign has to make a determination of where they're going to deploy limited resources. And so it's one thing to win the WFP endorsement, but if that you've done that because instead of having somebody in New York where you feel fairly confident where you're going to do okay, and you've put that person in California and you win California, then, you know, after the fact, it looks like it makes more sense. I mean, that's the thing. With these things, it is very easy to critique in the moment, but you really don't know until the end of the campaign, unless it's something that's hugely glaring. I mean, I remember in the fall of 2016 hearing about the amazing ground campaign that Hillary Clinton had. And
the best one ever assembled.
It turns out what that was just people saying that was the case. Like, I think, let me just put it this way. I think that you can overinterpret the failure of the WFP to endorse Bernie. And, you know, that's the only thing I would say.
I mean, I don't think it's going to move the dial much. I don't think it's really a big deal. I'm just talking about, like, other little points of concerns because these are, like, little things that I thought he would be on top of. Or I don't think, like, even my concerns, I'm not sure, like, how big of a deal they are. But it's just, like, the media is never going to give him fair representation.
Well,
so I thought his digital strategy would be more involved in terms of registering people and getting people, like, interested and like active.
They may be doing that.
What
I'm saying is that you're looking at that from a New York perspective. They may have made the assessment that the return on investment is better in a place like South Carolina, or is better in a place like New Hampshire or California than New York.
Yeah, and they might be doing voter registration down there. I mean, are we sure that they're not?
Well, that's what I've just said.
Because I agree that it's important to expand the electorate, because people who favor Elizabeth Warren over Bernie Sanders, Bernie might not be their second choice. These are completely different constituencies. You know, Warren is supported by largely the professional class. The people who support Bernie are poorer, younger, and less white. And I don't know if those, if the professional class folks are ever going to form a coalition or throw their weight behind Bernie if he's not the nominee, if Warren is not the nominee. They might be more likely to go for like Harris or Buttigieg or something. But I just want to add that that is one of the main areas of focus that DSA for Bernie is doing right now in New York City. We're registering people to vote largely on the campuses of public colleges and universities where there are a lot of young people and people of color who'd be more likely to vote for Bernie.
I appreciate the call.
I agree that his coalition is better, but I just want to say, like, I just wish with the Joe Rogan interview, because it was so big, like 10 million people, like, I feel like in terms of capitalizing on it, like, I'm not sure how many people, like, actually registered out of that.
Yeah, I don't know
and, like, also his, like, in terms of debate, like,
I don't know how...
I feel like...
I don't know how you would reach... the Joe Rogan people
I saw a lot. I think that was the type of operation. And I did see a lot of people. I mean, just even in the comments on that video, I saw a lot of people saying, hey, if you're in Florida, wherever, that type of thing. But yeah, I'm not. I have nothing else to add. I wonder if in New York, it seems to me that probably all of us could do a better job on letting people know about the October deadline. But I think they're doing most of what you're saying. I do.
Appreciate the call.
Yeah, I'm sure volunteer-wise they're doing really well, but I'm not sure about, like, in terms of the digital strategy.
Yeah, I don't know. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Just put that Chiron back up on the screen.
There's nice. How's that for a digital strategy? Boom. Calling from a 509 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hi, this is me.
Yes, it is.
Oh, hi. My name's Sean. I'm from Southeastern Washington.
Sean from Southeastern Washington. What is on your mind?
My mom is a nurse who works at one of the local hospitals. It's a Cadillac Regional Medical Center. They're owned by Providence Sacred Heart. Huh. I know they just met last night because I think they're going to go on strike. They're in negotiations with Cadillac right now. They're trying to take away their PTO accrual rate and the cap to it, effectively like a pay cut for them. There's also safety concerns. Some nurses have been attacked at I don't think they're the only hospital in the state it's happened at. And I don't know for sure if they're going to go on strike. The WSNA.org, the union website, is saying they are preparing for it. But I was talking to my mom about it. She wasn't sure if they were going to, like, talk about if they were finalizing their decision or talking about the details. So not 100% on that at this point.
Well, if they do, let us know. We'll keep an eye out. I mean, I know some people who have, been working as nurses in facilities that have been bought out. And a lot of big hedge funds are buying these hospitals. And they just come in and they basically just overwork, particularly with the nurses. And it's brutal, really brutal. Yeah, keep us updated on that.
Yeah, I've already heard really weird stuff, like with the safety thing. They want to, like, they want the nurses to take, like, an equal responsibility in handling the, like, the violent patients if it happens. And, like, that just seems really, like, outside of the purview of their job description.
I would imagine.
And, and other weird stuff. I guess, like, one more thing. A libertarian thing, I guess. Not, like, kind of like the prior caller. I have a guy I went to high school with. Have you guys ever heard of the Free State Project at all? It's something started by Jason Sorens. Not familiar, but I don't know if you guys have heard of it.
They were trying to move up. They were trying to basically take over. Yeah.
I think I went on Free State Domain Radio or something like that a couple of years ago. Is that something like that?
Yeah, a buddy. I guess kind of a buddy. I went to high school with him. He's a libertarian. He's moved out there for it. And I get into it sometimes on Facebook with him.
Are they connected
really
to Facebook?
Like, part of me wants
in their
to see
free
succeed, but...
in their free state that they live in? Are they connected to Facebook? How do they do that?
I'm not sure. I just know I only knew of it from talking to him. And like, part of me wants to see it happen just because I think it'd be funny. But then I've never met a bad person from New Hampshire, so I don't wish bad things on them.
Right. So. New Hampshire's full of good people. So. All right. Well, listen, I appreciate the call.
Yeah, thanks for taking it. I love you guys. Love what you do. Bye.
Thanks. Thanks. Keep us updated on the strike. Water boat from Kashmir on the IM, day 45, Kashmir. So other than arrests and disappearances, there are intermittent temporary detentions, which are essentially torture sessions of young men and teenagers. People have to report to army camps every few weeks where they are beaten. In one instance, a person reported for beatings 3 times in 5 weeks. If you pass out from the shock of extreme pain, you don't want to regain consciousness before the pain is gone. It is the most awful feeling. That is precisely what Indian forces are doing through electric shocks to people that pass out during beatings. There have been multiple reports of men and teenagers being beaten and given electric shocks right in the streets outside their homes where their family members can hear their screams for hours. Last week's headline in HuffPost, India beatings, electric shocks, threats to take away women. Did I mention rape threats? Finally, there have been 2 separate documented cases of soldiers breaking into homes, demanding they hand over their sons for pelting stones. Except the families had only daughters. They're terrorizing the population by making examples of some people in every community. All I have mentioned here is from the Indian press or international press. Don't stop talking about Kashmir. It's the only hope we have. It's the only way to ensure a non-violent response.
And also real props. Last night, talked about Jan Schenkowski, who's a congresswoman from Illinois, speaking very powerfully on Kashmir. One of the very few.
It's amazing how little it is in the American news.
Totally. And it's and again, from a, you know, Imran Khan just gave an interview for Al Jazeera. He's the Pakistani prime minister. And I'm, you know, there's a similar dynamic where now you get accused of being like, you know, spouting Pakistani propaganda. And I can assure you, I'm not pro-Pakistani.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, there's always a possibility.
I got ideas.
I mean, I don't know. Imran Khan's got a lot of ideas. Sorry, your board isn't up. Yep.
Go ahead.
Wait, go for it.
I'm not going to now.
But you got your finger on the button.
No, I don't. Go.
So Imran Khan, who I don't support necessarily... And the Pakistani government, who I think doesn't make its case as well as they could in the Western media, but they have a strong case to make. He said, I love it. Hi, this is Imran Khan. The Pakistani government is now a $3,000 a month patron at TMBS. And I'm hoping that this can be integrated into your communications. But he said, we could have a armed conflict with India. And he said it in this interview. It's like very important to clarify. He literally said, by accident. He didn't say, I'm threatening it. This is what I want. He said, this is already such a tight situation
right.
that this could absolutely lead to
it's
that.
It's also event. Sort of a threat. It's like, you got a lot of nice vases around here. Well, this could fall right over here.
It's a threat, and it's also
true.
It's logistically like, yeah. I mean, they're right. They already do have skirmishes. Kashmir already was the most militarized place on the planet even before this.
Well, hopefully Donald Trump will send Jared over there to work on this. And
well, this is, you know, that would happen a couple weeks before this happened was the press conference with Imran Khan where Trump's like, these are both great countries. Kashmir is a big deal. I'd be happy to help. Right. Imran Khan was like, okay.
Right.
And Modi was like, I absolutely did not ask you to help on this. And there's a domestic implication because the Indian Supreme Court has said that normalcy needs to return and nothing so far has changed. So that also has implications for this broader erosion of Indian democracy.
Next time they should come out and come from normalcy. Not so much normalcy.
You're being a pederast
again.
Helen
Cole. Sonia Sotomayor was on The Daily Show last night. She lamented the fact that most people have never read a Supreme Court decision and in the very next breath recommended to her position against video recording in their courtroom. The federal legal community is a bog of oligarchic jerk-offs. I mean, it's
all of them.
It's unbelievable. We don't want anybody preening, but we're going to require everybody to, give me a break.
# abolish the Supreme Court.
Ben Shapiro, puberty blockers. You went to college 35 years ago. I knew you were almost too old to be Gen X, but yeah, now I get why everyone calls you a boomer. I'm not, I'm a Gen X.
It's taken hold.
Why are you so proud of being part of Gen X? Gen X is terrible.
I'm. It's not a question of pride. I think the boomer generation worse though. Because
higher upside, lower downside.
The Gen X sucks, but because of the boomers.
Oh, well, that's the most Gen X line ever.
Yeah, man.
That's all you guys did is blame the boomers.
Well, you know, we had sorry that we're accurate.
We had to vote for Reagan and be lame because
Dr.
of
G's
parents.
Magic Elixir. Do you suffer from persistent sore throat, surrounded by diseased immigrant hordes doing preposterous voices on radio every day? Hi, this is Dr. Sebastian Gorka for Ricola, the original. Okay. Leaf
How
sage.
How are you going to go from knockoff like fish oil to Ricola? That's like upgrading
total.
A sketch, bro.
Leaf sage. Republicans are worried about state standards, setting standards for the whole country. Well, I'm sure they're outraged that the Texas Board of Education leverages its market share to ensure every American child can only read conservative-friendly textbooks. Yes. That's a real problem, actually. Skinny Pete, what are your opinions on open versus closed primaries to the crew?
Whatever helps Bernie.
Yeah, I'm going to go with whatever helps Bernie.
I don't think there should be open primaries, but I do think that you should be able to have same-day registration. I mean, that's I think you got to make it easy
problem.
To vote, but I think you also want to make sure that there's a disincentive for people who don't really care about the outcome of, you know, aren't genuinely invested in who the nominee is, you know, in a sincere way, at least. I would say you need to register, same day registration. Rick from Florida, and obviously registration before that. Rick from Florida. Hey Sam, speaking of free speech warriors, I notice you guys don't really pay attention to Tim Pool. I think your public attempts to discredit Rubin have largely worked. Tim Pool operates in the same lane as Rubin, being a disaffected liberal at the front lines of the culture war. And his videos get far more views at this point than Rubin's do. In terms of people injecting toxicity, he's up there with anybody. I think warrants some coverage. You know, Tim reached out to me a while back to do a show, and I said I would do a show. And then I would hear back from him like a week later, and he'd say, what about Saturday at 8:30 out in New Jersey? And I'm like, no, I can't do that. I can't. And then he would just, then it was hard. It's hard to organize.
Is this another person I need to know about from the internet?
Maybe.
Marginal.
Joe from the West Hartford. After hours of research, I finally figured out a definition for libertarianism we can all agree on. A real libertarian is someone who justifies slavery within 5 minutes of talking to Sam. Producer Lauren.
That's actually a really, that's a solid... That worked.
Liberty.
Producer Lauren, I looked up Billy Bragg on Wikipedia and it seems he's not only a Remain supporter, but he still supports the Labor Party, not the Greens or the Respect Party. And you failed to call him out on that. Or he thinks various components of the UK, like Northern Ireland, should break away after breakfast.
Delusional. Of course he's a Labor supporter.
Where does that come from?
Yeah. Wait, if Billy Bragg started supporting Respect Party?
I got news for you.
No, man.
I confused. That's Galloway's party. So they're making a hard left point. I thought they were making a really ridiculous point, but it's still wrong.
Well, what is he supposed to support? The Brexit? Like, that's not a left wing position.
If I was in Britain, I would imagine I would be a Remain supporter.
Yes, you'd
be a Labor Corbynite Remainer.
You'd be a Corbynite Remainer.
Dolink, Republican tantrums in hearing yesterday were clearly premeditated and scripted. The best part was after staff effective questioning Assistant Chair Representative Collins, the most obnoxious and aggressive spoke up to say he was a staff questioner for the other side. Nadler slapped him down. You're elected, not staff. You got 5 minutes. Jonathan Armstead. Hey, guys, watch your debate coverage twice. If you could catch all the questions asked in every debate, what would it be? If you could have a catch-all question in every debate, I have two. I think every candidate should be asked what they'll do once they leave office. I want to know what their big plan is. And also I want every moderator to ask what donor asked for a one-on-one meeting with a candidate and what promise they asked for. Curious to see how Mayor Pete would wiggle out of both. You know, I like that question about what you would do after being president. I mean, I think one of the most revealing things about Obama, now I can imagine the Obamas feel like they went through a nightmarish 8 years and they're going to live out their best lives. And they're going to do that by, you know, Netflix and I don't know, going to, you know, taking a trip to Mars on, you know, Virgin Airlines, you know, rocket ship or whatever, you know, whatever it is they're doing.
They're not just watching Netflix. They're making things. They're producing things.
That's
for
what I'm
Netflix.
Saying. Yeah. Yeah, that's I'm going to go work on Netflix and, you know, join Hollywood. And I don't know that they would have had a different answer beforehand. I mean, obviously they would, but it would be interesting to see sort of like just to get a broad
notion. I just
want
to help people tell stories.
Exactly. Attorney Andrew, all there is to say is she needs a movement too. I don't know what that means. Ryan from Ohio. Boring. Now that musician guests are back on the table, what are the odds of getting another Peaches interview? That's pretty funny. Secret identity politics. Not to pick on you and the crew, but how much of an anti-PC culture is just down to most comedians being miserable, dumb guys who specialize in a cynical art form?
And well, whatever.
It's definitely part of it.
Do we give comedians too much credit as a barometer of where our culture is? Is this all Twitter's fault? I see people having arguments over Joe Rogan and don't know what to make of it. I still don't know what call-out culture is.
This sounds like a really funny IMA.
No, I mean, I think... how much of anti-PC culture is just comedians being dumb, you know, miserable dumb guys who specialize in this? I mean, I think there is a genuine, I'll tell you what anti-PC culture is. It's the conservative movement, frankly. I mean, it is, the president of the United States has called out PC culture as a rallying cry for his people. I think
it's a paper tiger.
I think there's really legit critiques of, you know, like Mark Fisher's Vampire Castle, which is a great essay that people should read and learn from. But I would say this.
I changed my mind about that. I think it's the worst thing he ever wrote.
It's
but continue.
It's a great piece. It's really important. And it describes a lot of toxic dynamics better than anybody else ever done. But I will say that if somebody starts their point of critique with the phrase PC culture, that's a tip that they're not making the enlightened left critique to make the left less toxic and immature, but more that they're going in the reactionary, like, Trump direction. So PC culture is definitely a tell.
I think if you look at the way Netflix is marketing some of these stand-ups, that they're, this is, I think it's corporate, like subsidized.
Well, that's everything.
Yeah,
that's,
I don't think it's,
but that's also,
that
but real. That's, but that's just different channel. Like, there's, you know, there's the Netflix for the woke people. There's the Netflix for the people who are going to, like, think, you know, be opposed to PC culture, whatever. That, I mean, yes, at the end of the day, it's all marketing algorithms for sure.
It's also a lot of rich dudes complaining about how they get treated by the larger culture, like rich, famous people with nothing else to be pissed off about. So I think you're going to get a little bit of a bias there.
I mean, I think it, much of it is just, you know, it, to a large extent, what Billy Bragg said it was on some level, which is people who have been used to being able to have their perspective dominate and not have any pushback to the crap they're dishing out. I mean, you know, this isn't, you can go and do whatever you want in comedy clubs. You can set up your own comedy club room. People do this all the time. You go to a restaurant Monday nights. I'm going to bring 25 people in here and you get the door, you know, you get the drink tickets and I get the door or whatever it is. Then you can go up and say whatever you want. It's just that people complain like, wait a second, I can't say what I want. I can't be daring and make a lot of money. That's the second part of this. You can say whatever you want. It's just that other people might say, like, I don't want you to have the ability to monetize that sentiment, and I'm going to prevent you from doing it by organizing the consumers to say, like, we don't want that. I mean, this is, it's like, I'm not being silenced because Who's the Caboose doesn't play regularly on ABC television.
Yes, you are. You should be very angry about that. You're being deplatformed.
No, I think at some point we're going to need to materialize that analysis a little bit more, but not at 227.
I mean, what? Like, what?
Not at 227.
Look,
that would be time efficient here.
We're all. I would never deny that there are some people on the left who maybe take things a bit far, take themselves a little too seriously, and annoy me. But if that is your main thing that you complain about, I don't trust you.
I just talking to like people who aren't like always in a leftist space. Like, I think plenty of people have different tolerances for, say, the blog economy of how woke is this most recent stand-up special. And I think,
well, that stuff's all trash.
Yeah, exactly. I think that does, like, a lot of people don't care about that stuff and think it's pointless. But I also don't think that changes their politics.
No, I don't. That's not my critique at all. But I also just in general, like, you know, when you're talking about people, you can't. Well, whatever. We'll talk.
All right.
I agree with that point.
All right. One more quick phone call. Calling from a 248 area code. If you're not calling from a 248 area code, you should hang up because we're not going to get to you. I apologize. Who's this? Where are you calling from? Who's this?
This is Zach calling from Michigan.
Zach from Michigan. What's on your mind?
Hello.
Hello.
Oh, hey. Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Can you hear me?
Zach.
Oh, sorry. Just wanted to. Yes.
What's on your mind? What's on your mind, Zach?
Hey, I just wanted to bring about awareness for the Back 40 mine. It's a proposed mine. It's already got all the permits approved, but it was in spite of all the regulators saying that none of their proposals are going to keep the Menominee River safe. The Menominee River is pretty important to Lake Michigan, and they didn't involve anyone in Wisconsin. I just wanted to bring that up to awareness. And just say I really like the program and really appreciate you guys taking on those losers like Dave Rubin and Jordan Peterson who have absolutely no idea what they're talking about. And it definitely does work because I've had lots of friends that have repeated a lot of that stuff and sometimes I don't even know how to respond. So appreciate you guys and that's about it.
Thanks for the call.
Okay.
Thank you. Great to hear that Michigan's really concerned about their water. It's not like they've had any problems with that in the past. All right. Read four or five email IMs, and then we're out of here. Gedry. My sister and I don't get along. She had me committed against my will. I was stripped of my rights and became a ward of the state. I was away. She went through all my things, including throwing out my bed. My mother just passed away June 30th, so I was trying to safeguard valuables. She bringing people in the house to sell things. She said... any advice? She said I was a danger to myself. Is there anything I can do to protect myself? Any advice would be greatly appreciated. Gosh, I have no idea how to advise that. I would maybe try and talk to an attorney. I really don't know in that situation. And... you know, but good luck with that. Sorry to hear that. Republican wrestling coach. The biggest lie award from last week's debate goes to Beto. About an hour into the debate, he said he went to a gun show in Arkansas and said the vendors, customers there agreed with him. They don't need their guns, would have no problem handing them to the government to be cut into pieces. If anyone could prove that conversation was anything but 100% made up, I would personally pay for Beto to move into Jamie's apartment. I don't know how anybody would be able to prove that, and certainly not here.
He's staying in the basement, by the way.
Kevin, did you watch the roast?
The basement?
Was there a roast? What roast? Ryan Chat, this is a message from Michael. I don't want to get defensive. You take this the wrong way, but I think the way you keep attacking Warren is very toxic. There are a lot of people who like both her and Sanders. I am one of them. Sanders is my number one. Warren is number two. I like Sanders, but some of his supporters just can't handle people liking other candidates or any critique of him. On a daily basis, there are a number of progressive talk show hosts who go out of their way to make sure they criticize her for even the smallest thing. What I fear is a good portion of people will not support Warren under any circumstance. Ben Dixon has done two episodes on this very issue.
It's a zero-sum game.
You got to be specific about the things we've said about Warren. Because otherwise
it
seems...
people do that, but...
otherwise, it seems like you're the one who can't accept a criticism of Warren, and this is not being big.
I just have to say that in a way that I don't do for any other candidate, I mention on both platforms that I'm regularly on, I give her credit in a way that's actually awkward, and I don't do for anybody else precisely because of the touchiness that is expressed in the IM. But at the end of the day, I'm going to talk about what's what. Sorry, grow up.
I think we've all been extremely fair to Elizabeth Warren on this show.
Exceedingly so.
Isha, I'd like to remind people, including Sam, that Iran had nothing to do with the drone strike on Saudi oil facilities. It was the Houthis in Yemen. somehow all of the mainstream media seems to have forgotten that fine point. It's also very bigoted to assume that all Shias are loyal to Iran. It's dangerous rhetoric to get Shias in KSA executed. Well, first off, let me say this. I've never suggested that it's been proved that or even that it's likely that Iran had anything to do with the drone strike. Secondly, if the Houthis in Yemen sent, even if it was an Iranian drone, the fact is they're at war with Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia is not using Saudi-built weaponry. They got their weaponry from us. Secondly, the idea in saying that all Shias are loyal to Iran, I did not say that. But to the extent that Shias are, there are Shias who are loyal. I mean, to say that Iran does not have influence in Iraq, I think is also silly. And to the extent that it has any influence in Iraq and was going to operate within Iraq, it was going to be in a Shia area. And the close proximity of U.S. Military, which I don't think should be there in the first place, gives Iran, through proxies, an opportunity to strike back. That's the only thing I'm saying there. So I don't think that's a controversial statement. I think you would find people who are experts in that would say that, because that's certainly where I heard it from. But I appreciate your point. Two more. Ruben's missing balls. Hey, just tweeted you guys a screenshot of a notification I received that Dave Rubin liked a tweet pushing the Ilhan Omar married her brother garbage. I'm not surprised
by
that.
He's tweeted stuff about that.
Oh, no, he's tweeted about that, yeah.
And final IM of the day. You a looser, you misspelled that. This whistleblower will uncover Trump's abuse of executive power. Me a genius. The Clintons' deep state is stopping Trump from revealing Neera Tanden killed Epstein by request. See you tomorrow. It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot. Hey folks, Hunt a Killer is the murder mystery box that immerses you in an ongoing experience. With every delivery or episode, you'll dive deeper into what it's like to be a detective, sifting through piles of documents, evidence, and case files until you crack the case. Right now, just for our listeners, you can go to huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off your first box. They only accept 200 members per day, so hurry to take advantage of this offer. That's huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off your first box. HuntAKiller.com/majority.